Well, good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate y'all joining again. I hope these Bible studies have been useful and edifying to you thus far. It's been a good exercise for me, being forced to kind of condense these books down into just a few pages. And my goal, as I said in my email, is to eventually have one of these handouts for each of these books and put it together into a book form that can be a tool for, any Christian. You know, you don't have to be a pastor or a preacher to get the benefit of it, but to understand and to just use it as a kind of a launching point to in your studies of the scripture. So jumping right in, we're in the second book of Kings, and this is going to cover a lot of material, 300 years. And so, rather than try and really rush through it, because I know we were down to like 1258 when we quit last week, I'm really going to just pick on the first 13 chapters today. So jumping into our questions, who's the writer of 2 Kings? And the short answer is, I have no idea. I can't find any clues in the scripture that would tell me who wrote it, or who penned it, rather. God wrote it, and he spoke through men to write it. As far as when it was written, we can tell two clues here. One, that it records both Israel, the nation of Israel, and the nation of Judah being taken into captivity. So obviously it was written after those events both occurred. But probably more interestingly is it also says that it was during the captivity that it was written. So in 2 Kings 17 and 23, it says, "So Israel was carried away out of their land to Assyria unto this day." So that's describing Israel has already gone into captivity in the nation of Assyria, and when it was written, that captivity was still ongoing. So it wasn't written, hundreds of years after the fact. It was still going on. Like we said, our time period is going to cover about 300 years. It's going to pick up where the narrative of 1 Kings really stops, which was with the death of King Ahab, who was, your notoriously wicked king. And what made him really so bad is that all the previous kings had led Israel, the nation of Israel, into idolatry, but it was, for some reason, it was a lower tier. They had these two golden cows that they were worshiping and saying, "These are the gods that led you out of Egypt." Whereas Ahab and his wife Jezebel import an idol named Baal, who was a Syrian idol, and His wife Jezebel is a Syrian princess, so they import this idolatrous religion, and really start practicing it and actually persecuting I'm not sure what the beeping is, sorry, and start persecuting the prophets of Jesus, not Jesus, well, of God. So, covering 300 years, that's going to go in through until the nation of Israel is taken into captivity by the Assyrian Empire. And then 130 years or so later, the nation of Judah is going to be taken away into captivity by the Babylonian Empire. And I put in an extension of that first chart that I did as the last page. And so really just the area we're going to be looking at is this roughly 60-year period from, Ahab is dead. So we're picking up in Jehoshaphat's reign and then going on down. So this column, over here will be the kings of Judah. And we've got them labeled J4, J5, J6. And then kings of Israel, A7, A8, I8. And, I did that primarily for these handouts because they've got some very similar names. They can be off by only just one letter. And so we want to make it clear who's who. So hopefully through the course of this, that will make it easier to understand what's going on. All right. So all that being said, let's jump into the chapter by chapter. When you pick up chapter 1 of 2 Kings, Ahab is dead. His son Ahaziah, this is the 7th king on Israel's side, he gets hurt. He falls through some lattice in an upper room in his house, and he's injured pretty badly. Well, he decides to send messengers to go inquire of an idol in the city of Ekron, and the name of that idol is Baal-zebub, which I think literally translates to Lord of the Flies. Baal-zebub, he says, "Go send messengers to ask this idol if I'm going to live." Well, at this time, prophet of Elijah is still alive, and so he actually intercepts the messengers as they were going to Ekron, and he tells the messengers, "You go back to your boss, Ahaziah, and tell him he's going to die." So they do, and Ahaziah gets the message, but he's displeased. In fact, he's pretty ticked about Elijah telling him that he's going to die, and so he sends groups of men to go capture Elijah and bring him to arrest him. So Elijah's sitting up on a hill, and this guy, a captain of 50 men, he and his 50 men, you know, enforcers are behind him. They come up to Elijah and say, "Oh, thou man of God, come down. The king wants to talk to you," basically. And Elijah said, "Well, if I'm a man of God, then the Lord send down fire and burn up you and your 50. And that's exactly what happened. So that captain and his 50 were killed. Second captain, same thing happens. Come up, you know, "Oh, man of God, come down." Elijah says, "If I'm a man of God, you know, send down fire and burn you up." And so this captain and his 50 are burned up too. Third captain with his 50 comes and basically falls before Elijah and says, "Lord, you know, Elijah, please, you know, consider, you know, my life and the life of my men. Have mercy on us, basically. May our lives be precious in your sight." And an angel actually speaks to Elijah and say, "It's okay to go with this guy. You'll be safe." So Elijah voluntarily comes down from that hill, goes to see the king, and gives it the message again. He says, "Because you went and inquired of this god of idol, Baal-zebub, you're going to die." And Ahaziah does die. So that's the end of chapter one. Picking up at chapter two is a transitioning from Elijah being the main prophet on the scene to Elisha. Now, God had told Elijah back in 1 Kings when he was on the Mount Horeb, which is also Mount Sinai, the same place where Moses got the law. This is where God came to Elijah in a still small voice and told him to do certain things. One was to find Elisha and that he was going to be the prophet in Elijah's stead, and also to anoint a couple of people to be kings, one over Israel and one over Syria. So Elijah, after he got that message, went and found Elisha. And since then, Elisha has been his servant and working for him and walking with him. And so now it's time for Elijah to be called home, and he's not going to die like a traditional person. And so they are walking through various cities. They go, I think, from Gilgal to Bethel and then down to Jericho, all these cities. They're relatively close to each other. And at each one, Elijah says, "All right, you wait here. I'm going to go on." And Elisha says, "No, I'm not leaving you." And so they keep walking on. And at each stop, the sons of the prophets tell Elijah, "Do you know that your master is going to leave you today?" He says, "Yes, I know. Just let it alone." So finally, Elijah says, "Well, I've got to go to the other side of Jordan." Elisha says, "I'm coming with you." And so they go to Jordan, and Elisha takes the mantle, which is like a clothing wrap, shawl, something that was wrapped around him. He takes it, and he wraps it, and he whacks the water with it. And the river Jordan divides in two. So this is very reminiscent to how the children of Israel came over into Canaan, the promised land, when Joshua came in, that the ark went into the water, and the waters divided, and it was just real symbol of the fact that God is paving the way for them to come in. So Elisha goes across Jordan with Elisha, and then he turns to servant Elisha and says, "What can I do for you? What's something I can do for you?" And Elisha says, "I would like to have a double portion of the spirit that's upon you." So the spirit of God was upon Elijah. Obviously, he was able to do things through the Lord that ordinary people weren't able to do, and Elisha wanted to have a double portion of that. Elijah tells him, "That's a hard thing. Basically, I don't know if that's going to happen or not, or whether the Lord will answer that." He says, "Here's how we'll know: that if you see me when I go, then the Lord has answered your request and you'll have it. If not, then you won't." And so shortly after that, a chariot of fire with horses of fire just swoops down and says it carried Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind. Now, in the process of that, that mantle that he hit the river with, fell off of Elijah and it fell to the ground. And so Elisha, who sees him go, he does receive that double portion of the spirit. And that's evidenced by him picking up that mantle. And then when he was walking back to Jordan, he whacks the water with the mantle and asks, "Where's the God of Elijah?" And the water parts for him too. At the end of this chapter, you get kind of this little random, seemingly random anecdote about Elisha healing some waters. They were poisoned, they were bad, it was a barren land. And what's interesting is, remember, they were going down to Jericho, which is right near Jordan. Jericho had been cursed by Joshua since they came into the land. It said, the whole city is cursed, everything that was in it, and that was why Achan got such trouble for stealing the gold and silver and the Babylonian garments, because they were cursed things, and it cursed the nation when he had them with them. And Joshua also cursed the city, say, "Cursed is whoever is going to rebuild the city." And we've already seen earlier in 1 Kings where someone does rebuild the city, and as part of that curse, they lost their first and their youngest child, son, their oldest and their youngest son, as the consequence for rebuilding that cursed city. So here we are at this cursed city that's already been rebuilt, and yet the waters there are still barren and poisoned. And so Elisha puts salt in the water, and God heals it. There's no longer poison. Later, the city of Jericho is known as the city of palm trees, a very lush and fertile thing. But up until this point, it had been, you know, just a completely barren place. That's Jericho. All right, chapter 3. Ahaziah has died. The guy who fell through the lattice, went to inquire of idol, he's dead. Toast. He doesn't have any sons, so his brother, Jehoram, and I put an AKA in the handout, Jehoram and Joram, same person. It's like a condensing of the name, a nickname, if you will, but it's just a compression of it. So Jehoram and Joram, they're the same person. So if you see it spelled differently, we're talking about the same guy. He winds up reigning for a period of 12 years. And while he was a bad, idolatrous king, he wasn't as bad as his parents, Ahab and Jezebel. So he had that going for him. He winds up making a treaty with the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, who was a good king and followed God. So the fact that he made a treaty with the king of Israel probably wasn't a good thing for Jehoshaphat, but either way. And they decide that they are going to take the king of Edom, who's still subject of king of Israel at this time, and they are going to go invade Moab. Why are they invading Moab? Well, Moab used to be a tributary to Israel. It's a tributary, someone who had to pay them tax, and they paid taxes in the form of like hundreds of thousands of sheep each year from Moab to Israel. Well, as soon as Ahab died, the king of Moab says, I'm not going to pay you anymore. And so Jehoram's trying to go basically reinstate his right to have control over Moab. So he takes Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom, and they go marching to Moab. And they go a long way around through Edom. Well, in the process of that, they run out of water. There's no water along the way. All these, you know, armies that are walking together and their cattle and everything are going to die. And the kings are just distressed. And so they wind up seeking out a prophet, someone they can inquire of God of. And someone says, here's Elisha, who's replaced Elijah. They said, he poured water on the hands of Elijah. Let's ask him. Now, Elisha is a little snippy. He says, you know, if it weren't for the sake that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, is here, I wouldn't even be talking to you. But he winds up revealing, you know, a prophecy that there's going to be a great victory delivered through God's hand by filling the valley where they're at with water. Now, remember, there's no water right now. Everyone's about to die of dehydration. He says, God's going to give you a victory by filling the valley with water, and he's going to do it without making it rain. There'll be no rain. So what happens is God's wind up sending water through the land of Edom. So, I mean, just imagine a river running across the land where there wasn't water before. That's basically what happened. And it fills the valley where they're at. And so at the sunrise the next day, the Moabites look out and they see all this water, but they see it as red water with the vision, you know, the sun's glaring off of it, and God allowed them to think that this is the blood of the armies of these three nations, Judah and Israel and Edom. And they think, well, they must have fought against each other. This is a great day. We get to go get the spoils of the war, you know, because when they traveled, they had all this gold and silver and valuable stuff. It was part of the fun of warfare, where you got the stuff. And so they were going to go take all the stuff. And so they come rushing to Israel's camp. Well, Israel comes out and just whoops them. So God delivers Moab into their hands in that time. And not only did they beat them in battle, you know, as Elisha said that they should do, they were going to go in and just absolutely destroy Moab. So any good land, anything that had been cleared for farming, every soldier as they're walking by was supposed to throw a stone into it. And any good trees that could be used for anything, they were to cut them down and knock down all the cities and all the walls. I mean, it was just pretty much an annihilation. And the king of Moab got so desperate that he tried to take him and I think 700 men and burst through a siege of the last city that was like the capital, I think. But they weren't able to. And so they had to go back into the city. And in like his desperation, he winds up making a human sacrifice of his eldest son who was supposed to reign after him. So that was... it's the conquering of Moab in chapter 3. Chapter 4, a widow, she was married to one of the sons of the prophets, comes to Elisha and says, you know, my husband's creditors are coming to take my sons away because of all the debts that we owe them, and they're going to make my sons, you know, indentured servants or bondmen to pay off the debt. And so God winds up providing oil to this woman. So Elisha says, "What do you have in the house?" And she said, "I've got nothing in the house but a pot of oil." And says, "Go borrow pots from all your neighbors, go in the house with your sons, and then pour out of the one pot that you have and fill up the other pots. And from what you've got, what you gain from that, you will sell to pay off the creditors, and then your sons will live off the rest." And so that's what she does. And so the Lord delivers her through that you know, miracle of the oil. Later in this chapter, we're introduced to a woman of Shunem, a Shunammite, who takes care for Elijah as he's traveling in her area. And the city of Shunem, on the maps in the back of my Bible, is roughly in the center of Israel. Okay, it's not near the coast, and that's important later. But so whenever Elijah's traveling by, she invites him in to eat with him. She winds up building a little room and giving him a bed and candlestick and everything where he can be comfortable when he comes to visit. And so Elisha asks, "What can we do for this woman?" And his son, or his servant Gehazi, says, "You know, she doesn't have a son, and her husband's really old." And so Elisha says, "Okay." And so he tells her, "You're going to be blessed with a son." So she has a son, you know, next year or so. The son grows up, not to be a full-grown man, still a lad, but he grows. And at some point, he gets a really terrible headache. He's out in the field with his father. His father sends him back to the house, says, "Go send him to his mother." And she holds him in his lap, in her lap, until 12 that day, and then he dies. And she puts him on the prophet's bed, Elisha's bed, closes the door, and then goes to get a servant and a donkey or a mule or something, and tells her husband, "I'm going to see the prophet." And he's like, "Is everything all right?" She's like, "It'll be all right." And so she goes and hightails it off. Well, Elisha at that time is in Mount Carmel, which is all the way on the coast, Mediterranean coast, long way down. So she travels, you know, hoofing it to get to Elisha. And eventually, you know, she comes back with Elisha, and Elisha restores, God through Elisha restores this son to the woman. This is the second example of a resurrection in the scripture. And then the third scene in chapter 4, it's kind of fragmented, is there's a man who brings his first fruits. You know, you're supposed to offer under the law the first fruits that you grew of your first harvest and offer to the Lord. Well, he brought 20 loaves of barley bread and some corn and some husks. And when Elisha's servant saw it, he says, "I can't put this before 100 men, you know, all the men that were with Elisha, you know, it's not enough." But Elisha tells him, "It's going to be enough and there'll be leftovers." And there were. And so you've got an early allusion here to Jesus, not only the resurrection in that chapter, but also to him feeding the multitude with insufficient quantities. And here it sounds like you have a whole lot more to work with than Jesus wound up with the bread and fishes on those two occasions. All right, so chapter 5, we're going to jump over to Syria. The top general in Syria over the whole army, his name is Naaman. Very valiant man, but at some point he contracts leprosy. And he has a little servant, works for his wife, an Israelite girl. She was stolen by a Syrian raiding party when they were going into Israel. She tells, you know, Naaman that, you know, there's a prophet in Israel, referring to Elijah, that could heal him. Naaman talks to the king of Syria, and the king of Syria says, "Well, that sounds like a good thing." And so he sends a letter to King Jehoram over Israel, the eighth king, along with some nice presents, saying, "Jehoram, I got my servant Naaman here. I want you to cure him of leprosy." Which really distresses Jehoram, because he's like, "What? I mean, how can I cure someone of leprosy? You know, does he think I'm a god that can, you know, kill and take life?" And I think he's really just trying to pick a fight with me. Well, Elisha hears about it and sends word to the king, says, "You send Naaman down to me so that Naaman and the king will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman and his large company and all their camels go down to Elisha's house, and they stand outside. Elisha doesn't come outside. Rather than coming out, he just sends a messenger out to him and says, "Naaman, go dip yourself 7 times in the River Jordan." Now, Naaman gets ticked. Like, he is thoroughly upset. He had it in his mind that Elisha was going to come out and call on the name of the Lord and strike his hand upon it, and he would be healed. And it was going to be really amazing to see. And so he's like, "You know, this is stupid. Let me go, you know, dip in the river. You know, the rivers back in Syria, there's a couple of them that are way nicer and cleaner than, you know, Jordan. Why would I do that?" And so he's leaving in a huff. his servants ultimately calm him down. They say, you know, if the prophet had asked you to do some really hard, great thing, you would have done it. How much better to do something easy? So eventually he complies. He goes and dips seven times and he's healed. And he tries really hard to pay Elisha, take some of his gifts, but Elisha utterly refuses, doesn't accept a single thing. So Naaman departs, going back to Syria. Well, Elisha's servant, Gehazi, decides, you know, his master let him off a little too easy, that he should have taken some of those gifts. And so Gehazi slips out the door and goes and chases Naaman down and says, he comes up with a lie saying, there's a couple of the sons of the prophets have come and we don't have anything to give them. Can you give us some silver and a couple changes of garments? And I think he asked for one talent of silver, unit of measure, and Naaman wound up giving him two. And he actually sent him with a couple of servants to carry the great weight of these gifts. And so Gehazi lets them carry it most of the way till they're within sight of wherever they're at. And he sends them off and he carries them in and he buries it or hides it. And then he comes before Elijah and Elijah's like, where you been? He's like, I haven't been anywhere. What are you talking about? And he says, now's not the time to be receiving gifts from Naaman. And what Gehazi ultimately received from that little episode is that he received Naaman's leprosy. So it was passed from Naaman and Gehazi got it for his greed, I suppose, for trying to cash in on the Lord's miracle. So in chapter 6, Elisha is with the sons of the prophets, and there's this category of people that you'll see in this book, and I guess in 1 Kings, where it's first really come up, is that people who are known as sons of the prophets. And so I don't know if they themselves are prophets or if their fathers were prophets and their descendants, but they seem to have some insight more than just the average person, and so I would suspect they're prophets. But anyway, you've got a group of these folks who are named the sons of the prophets, and they are living together, and they say, you know, this area is too small for us. We need to build a bigger building. Let's go down here, and everybody cut down a tree to build it. Well, during the course of this is when one of the men is chopping down a tree, and the axe head flies off and falls into the water, and he's distressed, saying, oh, the axe was borrowed. What am I going to do? And Elisha asks, you know, where did it go? And he points it out. And I think he tossed him a stick there. And the iron axe head floated up to the top, which is a miracle in and of itself, because iron doesn't float. So that's kind of your first scene in chapter 6. Later, Syria, their king decides they want to ambush Israel. And so three different times, Elisha sends word to Jehoram, king of Israel, that the Syrian king's going to ambush you, and they're going to ambush you right here. And this really ticks off the Syrian king. He decides, you know, after he finds out who's telling him, because first he's accusing, you know, men in his inner circle of being informants and traitors, and they're like, nope, it's a prophet down there in Israel. He's telling the king, you know, things that you say, you know, in your bedroom when no one else is around. So he decides he's got to deal with Elijah directly. So he sends a band of men to go capture Elijah, and he happens to be at the city of Dothan at this time. And so they surround the city of Dothan. Elisha and his servant wake up one morning and they see this great host of the Syrians that are completely surrounding the city. And the servant panics. And this is when Elisha says, fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. And he prays that God would open the servant's eyes. And he does. And then the servant is able to see that God's host is encircling the Syrian army, that on the mountains there was these chariots of fire and horsemen of the Lord's host that were surrounding the army of Syria. And so Elisha asks God to smite them with blindness. And so everyone in the host of the Syrians became blind, their army. And he leads them and says, you know, the man you're looking for is not here. Follow me. And so he leads them all the way to inside Samaria, which is the capital of Israel, to the king, Jehoram. And you know, King Jehoram's like, oh, should I kill him? Should I smite them? And Elisha's like, no, you treat them how you'd treat any other captive that you'd captured with a sword. Feed them well and send them on their way. And so he does. But after this, the king of Syria just gets really angry. I mean, it's embarrassing. I mean, you send a band of men and they've been captured and, you know, didn't lose a single man. They just look like a bunch of wimps. Anyway, so the king of Syria, his name is Ben-Hadad. He gathers his whole army and he goes down to Samaria and he lays siege to it. And so, you know, basic practice of siege is I'm going to starve you out. Nothing gets in, nothing gets out. And so those inside Samaria are really struggling. There's no food. And there's some really graphic details in chapter 6. I mean, people are reduced to eating dung and even their own children. Just terrible things that are going on during the siege. So in chapter 7, when Elisha tells, you know, the king and his nobles, the next day there's going to be plenty in the city. You're going to be able to buy fine flour. You're going to be able to buy barley for very little money. Because, you know, if you wanted to buy a donkey head or a piece of dung to eat, it was costing a lot of money then. Supply and demand. There's no supply. He said there's going to be such a supply tomorrow that everything will be very cheap. One of the nobles who heard that said, you know, basically mocks him and says, you know, if the Lord opened up the windows of heaven, could such things be? And Elijah says, you're going to see it happen, but you're not going to taste it. So the next morning, or before the next morning, at the break of dawn, some lepers who are outside the city of Samaria, you know, the lepers are, you know, separated. They can't go into the city. There's no food in there. And they can't really leave because Assyrians are camping around. And so they decide, you know, if we sit here and do nothing, we're going to die. If we go in the city, we're going to die from starvation. The only chance we have of not dying is going and surrendering to the Syrians. Worst thing they can do is kill us. Okay, we're like that for any of the other scenarios. So they decide they're going to go to the Syrian camp. And they get there and they discover the camp's still there. All the donkeys and horses, everything they were riding was still there and tied up. All the stuff was still in their tents, the food, the money and everything. But the people were all gone. And it turns out that God had scared them all away by causing there to be a noise. They heard a noise that sounded like a great host. And they thought Israel had hired some other armies to come fight them. And so they fled. They just fled in the middle of the night. Now, when the lepers, you know, first they raid a couple of tents and hide the stuff. They're like, you know, we probably ought to go tell the king. It would be bad if we don't share this good news. So he goes and they tell it to the porters. And the porter goes and wakes the king up in the middle of the night. So it wasn't at the break of dawn, but still at night. And thinking that it's a trap, King Jehoram of Israel gets up and says, you know, they're probably just hidden around the corner. If we go out there to get the food, they're going to come into the city and they're going to defeat us. So his servants say, you know, there's 5 horses left in the whole city. Let's take a couple of them and go check. And so they do. They take 2 chariot horses and they go following the tracks of the Syrians as they're fleeing. And the whole way they're fleeing, there's things being cast off so they can run faster. And they follow the tracks all the way to the River Jordan to make sure that the Syrians have actually left. It's not a trap. So they have. And then the people pour out of the city because they're desperate for food. I mean, they were eating their own children yesterday. They're hungry. And so the guy who was in charge of watching the gate that day was that noble who had mocked Elijah and said, you know, can such things be if God opened the windows of heaven? So in the rush, he is actually stampeded. He's crushed to death in the stampede they walk on. So he got to see the things, but he didn't get to actually taste them. In chapter 8, we meet the Shunammite woman again, the one that Elisha healed her son, or the God healed her son through Elisha from chapter 4. He goes to her and says, there's going to be a terrible famine. It's going to last 7 years. You need to get out of town, go find a place where you can wait it out. And so she does. 7 years later, she comes back, but someone has taken her land. And so while she's been gone, and so she must go to petition the king to ask for it back. Now, her husband, who is old, likely would have been doing this for her if he was still alive. So I suspect that he's dead at this point. Doesn't explicitly say. But she comes to ask the king. And the day that she comes happens to be the same day that Gehazi, remember that leprous servant of Elisha, was in the court talking to the king about some of the great things that Elisha's done. And he had just finished the story about him bringing a boy back to life. And says, and here's the woman whose son it was. And so she's got great favor with the king at that time. It's piqued her interest, obviously. And so he gives her, you know, an officer to go make sure that her lands are given back. And not only that, all the fruit that the land bore in her absence. So she wasn't working the land. Someone else was working it for themselves. But they have to give back all the fruit to her as well. And then the next scene of this chapter, Elisha travels to Damascus. That's a city all the way in Syria. Long travel. King Ben-Hadad, remember him, who besieged Samaria and then ran away, he's sick. And so he says, I hear there's a prophet in town in Damascus. I'm going to send my servant, Hazael. He is a top commander in the army. He says, go ask that prophet if I'm going to get better. And so Hazael comes to ask Elisha, and Elisha tells him, Ben-Hadad will recover. But then he's staring at Hazael and says, but he'll still surely die, and tells Hazael that he's going to become king and he's going to do all these horrible things to Israel. And it's really sad. And Elisha winds up crying about it because Hazael's just going to, you know, destroy the cities and dash the children and kill pregnant women. Just terrible, terrible stuff. But as he's telling him that he's going to be the king, this is the fulfillment of God's instruction to Elijah's master, Elisha. Elijah was on the mount with God, got the instruction to tell Hazael that he was going to be the king of Syria. So years down the road is when Elisha fulfills that. And so that's referenced back in 1 Kings 19 and 15. So Hazael goes back to his boss, Ben-Hadad, the king, and says, Elisha says you're going to recover. But he'd also heard that one day he was going to be king. And so the very next day, he takes a towel, soaks it in water, thick towel, and goes and smothers Ben-Hadad to kill him. And that's how Hazael becomes the king of Syria. So third scene in chapter 8 is Jehoshaphat, who's been our king this whole time in Judah. We'll jump back down to our chart. Jehoshaphat, he reigned for 25 years. He finally dies. So he's got an alliance with Ahab, and Hazael, and then Jehoram, right? So we're right here where Jehoshaphat has died, and so his son Joram is going to be next. Where are we at? There, chapter 8. So his son Jehoram, J5, reigns in Judah for 8 years. But he's not a good king. Unlike Jehoshaphat, who tried to follow God and follow in his past, his son Jehoram got into the same kind of idolatry that was going on in Israel. He actually even marries one of Ahab's daughters, Athaliah. Okay. So upon Jehoram's death, which he reigns for 8 years, we don't know much about him, his death, his son Ahaziah, J6, reigns for just 1 year, but he also does evil. He followed the evil of the house of Ahab. And during the course of his 1 year, at the end of it, he winds up traveling to the city of Jezreel to visit Jehoram, who he's found is taken sick. So king of Judah goes to travel to Israel, to city of Jezreel. That was where Ahab and Jezebel kind of had their home camp, to visit Jehoram, who's sick. And I believe Jehoram is the grandson of Ahab at this point. So chapter 9 picks up with Elisha fulfilling God's other instruction to Elijah to anoint Jehu. We haven't met Jehu before this, but anoint Jehu as king over Israel. So Elijah sends a prophet to a city in Gilead. Remember, Gilead's on the far side of Jordan in the northern region, East Manasseh. So the city of Ramoth in the region of Gilead. So it's called Ramoth-Gilead, to anoint Jehu to be the king over Israel. And to give him instructions. The instruction is that Jehu is to destroy the whole house of Ahab for their wickedness and idolatry. And so every male has to be killed. And so that was Jehu's instruction. So Jehu and his followers apparently are very excited about this. Here he's going to be king. So they get up quickly and they immediately go to Jezreel to attack it. And so in the process, they kill the king of Israel, Jehoram, who's the grandson of Ahab, fulfilling that instruction to kill the whole house of Ahab. He also kills the king of Judah, Ahaziah, J6, who was the grandson of Ahab on his mother's side. So both kings of both nations have been wiped out at this point. And Jehu also fulfills the prophecy that Elijah had spoken against Jezebel. Ahab's wife's still alive at this point. She's, you know, outlived husband and son. And so he comes to the tower where she's poking her head out the window and popping off at him, saying he didn't turn out for the last, you know, servant who killed his king. And he says, you know, who's on my side? And there's a couple of eunuchs who poke their head out the window, and he says, toss her down. And so they pick her up and they chunk her out the window, and she, you know, hits the ground. And if that didn't kill her, then the horses stomp on her as they walk by. But Elijah, back in 1 Kings 21 and 23, had made a prophecy against Jezebel that the dogs would eat her. And that's what happened. So Jehu, after Jezebel's death, goes and has a meal. And then he says, you know, she was a princess. We need to bury her properly. And so they go send someone out to bury her. But all they could find, I think, is the hands and head, because the dogs eat roast. Really gross, but fulfillment of that prophecy. So chapter 10 gets into the fulfillment of Jehu wiping out the rest of Ahab's house. And he actually does that by telling the nobles in Samaria, where 70 of Ahab's sons or descendants are being raised by the various nobles. He's saying, you know, you pick the king. Pick whoever you like best. Let him be the king, and then I'll come fight him. And the nobles say, you know, he's already killed two kings that weren't able to stand before him. We don't have a shot. And so they said, you know, we will just take care of these 70 for you. And so they wound up beheading the 70 and sending them to Jehu. Now, Jehu, so he wipes out Ahab's house. He also wipes out all the worshipers of Baal. Remember, Jezebel had been stalling, you know, servants to Baal and prophets for Baal. And they've been harassing all the prophets of the Lord. So he wipes out the worshipers of Baal. And so that's good. So two good things in his obedience. But he still follows Jeroboam, who was original king of Israel, his sins in following those golden calves. So the Lord winds up sending word to Jehu that since he was obedient on the matter of the house of Ahab and obedient on the followers of Baal point, his children would be allowed to be king unto the fourth generation. It's not going to go any farther because he wasn't fully obedient since he continued in Jeroboam's sin. So he winds up reigning for 28 years. And then his son, Jehoaz, I-10, becomes king. So that was the follow through of what happened on Israel. And remember, on Judah's side, their king's dead too, right? He had been off traveling in Israel, and he's wiped out by Jehu. So what's going on in Judah is picked up in chapter 11. So going back in time, hearing that her son Ahaziah is dead, Athaliah decides, this is his mother decides she wants to be queen. And so she kills all the royal children and declares that she is queen over Judah. And she winds up being successful, and she reigns for 6 years. Only one little problem is that one of Ahaziah's sons, Jehoash, two different spellings, same name, again, the condensing of it, was spared. The child's aunt hides him. He was only 1 year old. And so infant, she hid him. They actually hid him in the temple for 6 years until the priest named Jehoiada winds up making this little boy, who's seven, king. And so really at the priest's direction, the people wind up breaking down the house of Baal and having Queen Athaliah slain. So this little boy in chapter 12, Joash, he does right. And he winds up following God during the whole time that Jehoiada the priest is still alive and instructing him. He winds up repairing the temple, which had been severely neglected. I mean, if you're not worshiping God, would he care about, you know, keeping his house up? But later in his life, he doesn't trust God. The Syrian king at this point, Hazael, remember Hazael who just killed Ben-Hadad? So later in time, Hazael is the king. He comes to fight Judah. And rather than trusting God to deliver him, Joash says, I'm going to send you a bribe. I'm going to take all the holy, hallowed vessels from the temple, all the gold, all the treasure of the house of God, and I'm going to send it to you, king of Syria. Please go away. And the king of Syria did. And so he bought him off to prevent him from attacking Jerusalem. After that, Jehoash winds up being slain by a conspiracy of his own servants, which is not so good. And he reigned, he reigned for 40 years, actually. So long reign. So he was 47 when he died. All right. And then last chapter, last one we'll cover today. Over on Israel's side, after Jehu has died, his son Jehoahaz, he winds up reigning for 17 years, and he does evil the same way that Jeroboam originally did evil, and Jeroboam being the first king of Israel. And the reason Jeroboam did evil originally and created up these calves was he didn't want the children of Israel going back to Jerusalem every year. He thought if they went back to Jerusalem, then eventually their loyalties would shift and they would go be underneath the king of Judah. And so rather than having them follow and worship God in Jerusalem like they're instructed, he created this false religion where you've got these two golden calves, one in the north part of Israel, one in the south part in Bethel in the city of Dan, and says, here, you stay here in town, you have your feasts here, just don't go to Judah. So Jehoaz follows in that patterns. So at some point during this, the God begins to deliver Israel into the hands of the kings of Syria, starting out as Hazael, and then Hazael later, it's into his son, Ben-Hadad. Now, it's a touch ironic, because Hazael is named his son, Ben-Hadad. That's the name of the king that Hazael murdered. So, just throwing that out there. So God begins to deliver Israel into their hands. And so King Jehoahaz, you know, even though he's been doing this false idol worship like Jeroboam, he still winds up beseeching the Lord to deliver them out of the hands of the Syrians. And God does. He's very merciful. He delivers them from the hands of the Syrians. But Israel is dramatically reduced or diminished in the course of this. Their fighting force is down to just a token army. They've got 10,000 foot soldiers, 50 horsemen, and really just 10 chariots, which is tiny because you remember when Israel came into Canaan under Joshua's lead, they had 1,600,000. I mean, just a gigantic army. And so, you know, time has passed, and, you know, expanded and got great under Solomon. But then after Solomon, when his son Rehoboam, you know, had the kingdom split into Judah and Israel, it's just kind of been a diminishing down. And so we're down to a really, really small fighting force at this point. And then chapter 13 deals with Jehoahaz's death. So your 10th king of Israel dies, and then his son, Jehoash, a.k.a. Joash, begins to reign. So listen, all these names are very similar, and if you're just kind of reading through it without paying really close attention, it's easy to kind of like, who am I talking about? So his son begins to reign. He does evil, just like Jeroboam, and he reigns for 16 years. All right, last little nugget in this chapter before we wrap up for the day. Elisha, who's now old, is on his deathbed. And the king of Israel, Jehoash, goes to visit him. And in the process, you know, Elisha tells him to shoot an arrow out the window, and he shoots. And he tells him to smite the ground with arrows, which are pointing to God's deliverance from the Syrians. But the king only hits the ground 3 times with an arrow, and Elisha gets really mad at him. He says, you should hit him 5 or 6 times. You know, that way God would have delivered the Syrians until you completely consumed them. This time you're only going to, you know, basically rebuff them or defeat them 3 times, and then eventually they're going to come and consume you. And so he dies, Elisha dies, and he's buried. And then there's this little anecdote at the very end about later there's a man who's being buried near Elisha's sepulcher, and there's an invaders who are coming in, you know, kind of a roving band of marauders, and the guys who are digging the grave get scared, and rather than continue the work and doing it right, they just say, let's just toss him in here into Elisha's sepulcher. And they do, and as soon as that man touches the bones of Elisha, he comes back to life. So that's your third example of a resurrection in the Old Testament. That's really it for today. I don't think we'll go any farther. So we've only covered about 60 years, but quite a few kings, you know, kings on Israel's side, 7 through 10 and 4 through 8 on Judah. So I'm going to